Committee on Finance and Revenue is open. Good morning, everyone. We're going to continue our sort of overview today and start bills on Monday. Today, we're privileged to have the new, relatively new director of the Oregon Department of Revenue, Nia Ray, with us. After that, Paul's going to go into a recently published white paper on gross receipts tax versus a corporate income tax. Kyle's going to grace us with his presence on senior deferral, and then we're going to look at school finance with Day, and probably squeezing the rest of that orientation that we started yesterday in the coming weeks. So let's begin with the new director, Nia Ray. If you want to come up with Mark. Your first and hopefully not final time before the Senate Revenue Committee. And Deanna Mack is with us too.
Good morning. Once again, I'm Nia Ray. I am the director of the Oregon Department of Revenue. I have with me Deanna Mack and Mark Garst, both legislative liaisons for the department. I will be leaning on them a bit today as I've been in the position for almost 4 months. I have enjoyed the 4 months, but this is a first for me. So I do ask for a bit of grace from the committee this morning. Before I move into the prepared agenda, just a little bit about my background and some observations of the department during my 4 months. As you may be aware, I was the Missouri Department of Revenue Director immediately prior to assuming the role with Oregon. And so I did have a bit of a perspective with respect to revenue departments and what was expected of a Department of Revenue. During my confirmation period, I had the opportunity to meet many of you, and you shared with me very candidly some of your concerns about the department, the way we collect our enforcement mechanisms, and perhaps some changes that you'd like to see in the future with respect to the way we operate. However, there was a consistent thread in the communication I had with all of you was that, by and large, the staff was quality staff. Many compliments were offered for the Department of Revenue staff, our commitment to what we do, and the thankless nature often of what we encounter. I echo that. As the director of the Department of Revenue for the past 4 months, I have indeed inherited a wonderful staff of individuals. I will caution, however, that I sense a bit of fatigue. As you are aware, we've undertaken a rather significant modernization upgrade to our IT processes, and it is taking a bit of a toll. And so as you make decisions about the department and the direction that we go into, please understand that we've taken on a lot. As a director, I've made it my priority to increase morale wherever possible, to try to offset some of that fatigue through communication, through encouragement. Unfortunately, we don't have many resources at hand to offer, but at the same time, whenever I can be of assistance in that respect, I try to do so. So please keep that in mind as you direct the department from a legislative perspective. With that, our agenda will be as follows. We'll have a very high-level agency overview of how we operate as a department, our obligations, responsibilities, and how we carry that out, our transition and stabilization related to our CSR project, which I just mentioned, and a very brief overview of the governor's revenue proposals. I understand that there was a presentation yesterday regarding those revenue proposals, but we will again present a high-level overview of some of her recommendations. The Department of Revenue's mission, vision, and values are taken very seriously. Every decision we make incorporates that mission, that vision, and those values. However, by and large, the role of the Department of Revenue is to collect money to pay the state's bills. And that's the expectation, that we collect every dollar that's owed to the state of Oregon so that public services can be maintained at an optimal level. And we do that through four major tax programs, the income tax programs, the property tax program. Even though collection is at a local level, we do offer administrative services and support to counties to collect property taxes. Also, our cigarette and other tobacco taxes and our marijuana taxes, tax programs are a significant tax program with respect to the general revenue. We've also included, just as a brief mention, some other small taxes, which we'll list later in the program. Our other agency accounts, we do assist our sister agency with agencies with collecting their debt, and other assistance programs, the senior and disabled deferral and nonprofit homes property tax exemptions. While they are not significant revenue drivers, they are programs that the department manages. With respect to those four major tax programs, the department plays various roles within the communities that are impacted by those programs. We will discuss all of these in more detail as we move through the presentation. So first, with respect to personal income tax revenues and how they're paid, personal income tax is perhaps the largest, it is the largest contributor to our general revenue amounts. And of that amount, 97% of the receipts are voluntarily paid. So people want to pay their taxes. We have mechanisms in place to assist the voluntary compliance of tax payment. Now, as a disclaimer, 75% of that voluntary compliance is through payroll withholding. So it's a little more automatic, but there are 13% to 15% of those returns that are through quarterly payments or some type of manual submission to the Department of Revenue. Only 3% is through our direct enforcement mechanism. There have been many suggestions from the legislative body, both House and Senate, with respect to increasing our enforcement to increase the amounts we receive from delinquent debtors, liquidated and delinquent debtors. And I've heard you, and I've had communication with our staff to review our processes, to discuss options for perhaps consolidating our collections unit and making efforts to address the concerns you have. It is more complex than just throwing more people at it. I mean, there are diminished returns at a certain level. We do have to consider all of that. But at the same time, I did hear you, and those discussions are being had. Personal income tax, as stated earlier, is a significant driver of our general revenue. And the income tax programs provide many opportunities for the taxpayer to engage with the department, understand their obligations, so that we are not simply an enforcement agency, but we're an education agency. We assist the taxpayers. We ensure that they understand fully their obligations, and we make every offer, make every effort to ensure that they understand those obligations. So the first bullet there, assistance in education, is a critical component in the department's collection process. That assistance is offered through our call centers, through outreach. We do take opportunities to physically go out into our communities and educate employers on withholding and payroll and other opportunities to inform our public about what we do and what the expectation is. The next bullet, processing, that's where the rubber sort of meets the road. That's where we actually receive the return. We process it. We determine if there are adequate amounts, there's adequate calculation. If there is any additional liability, we make the determination at that point. Banking, the majority of the submissions are electronic. But we also still process checks and other forms of payment. Filing enforcement, if the first three bullets aren't met, then we move into our enforcement stage. And that's where the notices of delinquency, non-filing. At that stage, we make contact with the individual to reiterate that there are obligations, set out again what those obligations are, and make every effort to get the taxpayer to comply. Finally, if we deem it necessary, we do have audit responsibilities to ensure that adequate liability is assessed. And finally, if those first five obligations aren't met, if they don't result in satisfaction of liability, we move into our collections function. So 93% of the general fund is connected somehow to those processes. Moving on to the second driver, property tax overview. Now, property tax is not supportive of our general revenue amounts directly. Property taxes are collected by counties, and they're collected by counties, and they fund local government processes and activities. The Department of Revenue, however, does serve a supportive role to those counties and an administrative role in many respects to those counties to ensure the effective collection of those taxes, those local taxes. So we serve a very important role and strive to improve our relationship with counties and county assessors and property tax administrators at the county level. Those functions, you can see on that top row, how the department interacts with localities to ensure the effectiveness of tax collection at the local level. And the first and probably best known responsibility that we have in connection with the local governments and the county governments is a central assessment and industrial property valuation. We are responsible, statutorily responsible, for assessing certain properties and valuating certain properties that an industrial property valuation case, if they are highly valued properties that involve manufacturing, centrally assessed properties, if they are one of several numerated properties, which would include telecommunication companies, railway companies, airlines, gas companies, water companies, we are responsible for valuating those properties. We also perform a centralized mapping functions to ensure that we know where everything is, and everyone knows where everything is, that there is one place that you can go to ensure that there's consistency in mapping. Annually, we assist in the collection of roughly $6 billion toward local government activity. Through our valuation process, we collected last year $636 million toward county governments through that valuation process. So that relationship is critical to localities, and we value those relationships and hope they do in return. On this chart, you're able to, you have a visual example of how the local funding and the state's general revenue serve to fund the state as a whole. And you, as you're able to determine education, human services, and public safety, the general revenue is a significant economic driver to public services in the state as a whole. The local governments, of course, are a significant driver, but they're largely dependent on our role both in the collection of local taxes and general revenue. So we are critical to that function. The third major program, the cigarette and tobacco tax program, is similar to the role we play in the cigarette and tobacco tax program is similar to the personal income tax program. There's still an education and assistance component to the collection of that tax as well. There's processing, banking, and collecting. We've been through that audit. Inspections and site visits. Unlike personal income tax, we make every attempt to ensure that individuals that are paying, that are obligated to pay cigarette and tobacco taxes do so, and do that through physical inspection and site visits to ensure that records are kept. There are record obligations for retailers, that distributors are paying for purchasing the requisite level of stamps. And so there is an inspection component to the collection of that tax, resulting in $532 million to general revenue. That revenue is distributed, however, to various funds. It is not strictly a general fund tax. As you can see there, a portion goes to the Oregon Health Plan, $133 million goes to the general fund, mental health program, city counties, and smoking cessation program. The marijuana tax has been a very popular topic of conversation for the past year. The most recent collection, the most recent amount of collection that has been publicized, and we every quarter we do submit a press release to you and to the public announcing the current amounts, $60.2 million. In tax collection for marijuana tax. I was not here when the original projections were announced, but my understanding is that that is significantly more than was initially estimated. And we have taken that very seriously. As you know, there are, have been some challenges toward the collection of the marijuana tax. We've taken those very seriously, but because there are some federal, not restrictions, but obstacles to the banking of marijuana tax proceeds, we've had to work very diligently to ensure the security of this particular set of taxpayers. It is a cash business, so we've had to modify our processes with respect to cash handling in this case. Very glad to do so. $60.2 million to general revenue is well worth it. $60.2 million toward revenue, maybe not general revenue, is well worth it. And so we have taken our obligation very seriously and thus far have not had serious security issues with respect to the collection of the marijuana tax. We intend to keep it that way. There will be some changes with respect to the way we collect the marijuana tax. Our location right now is not optimal. There are some other changes that we hope to make this a better a better process, more efficient, and even safer for the individuals that are involved in this business. But that being said, we are pleased with the application of resources at this point. Yes. Briefly mentioned earlier, while personal income and corporate property tax, cigarette and tobacco, and marijuana are the main general revenue drivers, there are other taxes and services that the Department of Revenue administers. And here's a list of some of those tax programs. Many of these have a report, an annual report, that you would find on the Department of Revenue's website that set out the tax, the progress on the tax, and just give you a general understanding of the tax and what it provides for. So I strongly suggest if you have free time, which none of us typically have, but if you ever are able to peruse the site, you will find a lot more information on these taxes. The Core Systems Replacement Project is the project I referenced earlier, and as I said, it has been a major undertaking of the department, and while we are very pleased with our success thus far, the project has remained on schedule and under budget. It has been a significant undertaking, and you can see why perhaps here when as you review the schedule of the project. The project is a four-phased project which has been rolled out every fall. One phase has been rolled out every fall since 2014. We just rolled out the withholding component of our tax program in this past November, and we're gearing up for the final phase of the rollout in November of 2017. The first rollout was in November 2014. It was corporations taxes and tobacco taxes. Those were our smaller taxes. So we started off with that tax program to ensure, number one, that we set the foundation, and number two, with the smaller tax, we were able to assess any issues, any risks associated with our plan of action. That rollout was successful. We moved on to rollout two, which was our personal income tax rollout. That was the big rollout. That was perhaps the riskiest rollout. And while these projects are necessary in this day and age, and these are nationally, departments of revenue are upgrading their infrastructures. You're dealing with 30-year-old legacy systems. We've got to move into the 21st century. But while we understand that this is a necessary project, there is risk involved. Many times you don't know how successful your rollout is until the rubber meets the road. So rollout two, we implemented our personal income tax rollout. It was successful. We had a few glitches last tax season, and we found out there were a few holes that we have subsequently plugged. However, for the most part, it has been successful, and we'll find out more about our success of rollout three in the near future. As stated, so far, so good. There are associated risks. Anytime you move in such a significant direction with revising your processes, there are going to be unexpected challenges. But for the most part, they've been surmountable. These are just a few examples of the positive impact of our GenTax program. I called it CSR. It's also known as GenTax. It allows real-time processing, risk scoring. It's improved our audit functions. We also have a fraud feature, fraud analytics tool that's associated with GenTax that is assisted in that respect. And as you are aware, fraud is an ever-prevalent issue with respect to not only tax, but government as a whole, but as the Department of Revenue, I'm more specifically interested in how it affects my agency. And fraud is a huge, huge issue. So we applaud any effort, any products, any resources that are appropriate to our department in combating that effort. So I just shared with you some of the challenges with our CSR project, which is the upgrade of our income tax programs. However, because we are a department that enjoys challenges, we are embarking on a property tax upgrade as well. So we are at the beginning stages of that property valuation system upgrade. Unfortunately, many of our local communities, many of our counties are already there, and we're behind. And we're still sharing files through Excel spreadsheets and in paper and writing notes. Well, it's time out for that, and we are moving into the 21st century, and we'll be upgrading our property tax system. So we will have more on that for you the next time we're here. As I stated, we are in the very beginning stages. We have yet to select a vendor on that project, but we are moving right along. Finally, with respect to the governor's budget recommendations, the governor proposed several revenue-generating measures in her budget recommendations, her 2017-19 budget recommendations that impact the programs we discussed, primarily the cigarette tax. And you can see here the cigarette tax and tobacco product tax increases that she's recommended. The governor also recommended several eliminations of credits and tax benefits that you see here, the partnership pass-through for non-passive income and the IC DISC dividend subtraction, which is primarily a benefit derived and a benefit that is unique to agricultural producers, agricultural exporters. So both of those have been recommended for elimination. I understand both of those were a part of a grand bargain that was entered into by various parties toward a certain issue. I wasn't here, I'm sorry. Finally, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission would be responsible for these tax increases, revenue generating measures. And so there would be an increase surcharge on distilled spirits, increase in alcohol licensing fees that would result in roughly $40 million in increased revenue. And there was also a recommendation to increase fees on health providers. Several tax expenditures were recommended for extension. And this is a listing of those recommendations. And thank you for your patience. That it ends my presentation for today. And I am, of course, available for any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for the new director? Okay, we're getting off easy today.
Thank you for your grace. I appreciate it.
Preservation.
Yeah.
All right, some of you have, I think it's on OLIS, a synopsis of a journal article came out from some tax experts on the changing dynamics and the arguments for and against corporate income tax versus gross receipts tax. And so, Paul, I'll let you kind of walk us through some of the key findings.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. There's actually two things. One is an article called the National Tax Journal article, which is the National Tax Journal is comes out quarterly, and this was based on their spring symposium from May of last year. There's a series of papers that were presented. I do also have, as Chair mentioned, a summary. It's called Business Tax Options Summary, which summarizes the paper. And if you'll notice that it may bring back some memories of higher ed learning. When you look at it, it's
yes,
very much an academic,
that feel.
Academic piece. But I will say that the authors are very well known in the state and local tax field, and I thought it was a good summary of a lot of the issues that you've talked about in this committee, and it was also a lot of issues that really came up in the Measure 97 debate, and it really revolves around what is the most appropriate way to tax business. They're one of the common questions we had during that debate over 97 was, is Oregon a low business tax or low corporate tax income tax state? And I think that one of the confusions during that discussion was people got business taxes confused with corporate taxes. Business taxes are very broad. There's a lot of ways that business pay taxes. Corporate income tax is one specific tax. So if you look at this summary document, there is one of the tables taken right out of the book, which is the second page there, Kyle. This shows you kind of the business tax options that we have talked about in this committee, but it's a good summary of how these work. They are structured by the ones at the top have the broadest base. And, of course, the beauty from a tax policy standpoint of a broad base is a low rate can generate significant revenue. And that, for most public finance economists, that's kind of a general goal of tax policy, because a broad base tends to be non-distorting or minimizes distortions along when it has accompanied with a low rate and can still be a powerful revenue generator. When you look at these three taxes that are discussed as general business taxes in the article, the first is the gross receipts tax. And, of course, this is something you've talked about a good deal. The examples there are the commercial activity tax in Ohio that started in 2006, the Washington's B&O tax, which has been around since the 30s, and then last year Nevada passed the Nevada Commerce Tax. which is a gross receipts-based tax. So basically, the gross receipts tax is the simplest tax. It's the broadest base. You're taxing it on the overall, the top line of your business tax form. So it gives you the broadest possible base. It is what economists call a destination-based tax, meaning that the tax is based on where the sale occurs, as opposed to an origin-based tax. Now, as you move down this list, Texas made a change to a gross margins tax that they approved in the early 2000s, which has a lot of characteristics of a gross receipts tax, but they do allow certain deductions. The main one, and they have, it's very complicated. They have three options for deductions. It's either you can deduct your labor expenses, labor compensation, or 30% of your total revenue, or cost of goods sold. So it's been criticized by some because of its complexity, but in general, it's a gross receipts tax that's allows deductions, so it's kind of a hybrid.
Senator Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the gross margins tax, you said if you eliminate your cost of sales, that's almost like a sales tax then, isn't it? Real similar?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bertrand, yes, the cost of goods sold, so it becomes closer to an income tax because rather than a broad sales tax. So that narrows the base considerably, yes.
Yeah, it would.
Seems like that kind of defeats the purpose almost.
It's definitely a more narrow base than a gross receipts base, yes.
In the sort of policy goal of deducting the compensation, though, seems to make sense because you are not penalizing companies who employ people in your state. Is that the purpose?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. You know, there's a lot of similarity between that and the corporate income tax with the sales apportionment formula. Whereas you add labor, it doesn't affect your tax liability.
Senator Taylor. Thank you, Chair. So, Paul, is there in this model for the gross receipts tax? Is there what about the types of businesses and how they're classified? So the C Corp, the B Corp, is there any exceptions or any of the states? I mean, who is included, who is not included? Are there any exemptions to that? Or
these two general approaches, both the gross receipts tax and the value added tax, are known as entity taxes, meaning that all entities are subject to them. There's no distinction between types of entities. You will see in the gross receipts tax, a similar in-lieu tax for financial institutions in many cases because they're difficult to measure in terms of what their sales or receipts would be. So they can pay something that would be equivalent but calculated differently.
Okay. Can I follow up? Thank you. So I read through this. Thank you for doing this. I didn't quite understand see in here how it ties in with the federal taxes. How would it tie in?
One of the major policy decisions, some would say advantages, if you were to go, for example, with a gross receipts tax or a value-added tax, you would basically be have no connection to the federal tax. Now, if you're down at this end, bottom end here, with the narrow base and the high rate, the corporate income tax, you're connected to the federal tax code. That can be, as you've seen with the personal income tax, can be an advantage and a disadvantage. It's an advantage in the sense that you have that administrative structure there. So our corporate income taxpayers, we start with this water's edge, and then you have your federal deduction. So you use your federal return as the basis for apportioning your state return. But on the other hand, federal law is fairly restrictive on corporate nexus. The public law 86272, which is pretty definitive, well, not real definitive, but is restrictive in terms of what determining nexus within the states. So you have to have an economic nexus for that to apply. So one of the advantages, and this is something that Ohio worked through as they went with a commercial activity tax, they have what's called a business privilege tax. It's just for the privilege of making sales in Ohio. So the nexus requirements are not as strict as they are for corporate income tax. So, again, if you're thinking here in terms of rates and bases, this gives you a broader base. one of the first things that happened in Ohio was companies that were not subject to the corporate income tax were being taxed for the commercial activity tax, and they, of course, were litigated that. But in general, my understanding is Ohio won most of those cases.
Senator Orchard. Paul, how does capital gains, you know, work into this, you know, from stock sales or real estate sales or stuff like that? How would that work into this?
Capital gains are part of the corporate income base, can be a part of net income, and it's not business related, but it's still part of that corporate return. So corporations do pay capital gains taxes if it was reported as this activity that's a result of the corporation but not directly related to the business. So it would still be part of the tax base.
And also on just the average citizen with a real estate sale or a stock sale, that we would still have that capital gains tax.
Yes, you still have for personal income tax, yes. Okay. For gross receipts tax, since you're not looking at net income, it would be from the sale, it would be your overall sale from your business activities. It's a business activities or privilege tax. So capital gains would not be incorporated in the gross receipts base.
So we would keep it too.
But you would keep it in the personal income tax base, right? Yeah, none of these proposals would change the personal income tax. Now, of course, the states we're looking at, two of them, Washington and Nevada, don't have a personal income tax.
Right.
But Ohio does. When Ohio implemented the CAT, they eliminated the corporate income tax.
But it could be one of our options,
right,
to eliminate it. Like Washington or Nevada.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You've got to find a carrot someplace.
Yes.
Right, Sister Chair.
So, but the next kind of in the middle here is the value-added tax. And the value-added tax was something that actually this committee looked at a lot, and the chair will remember this, in the early 2000s. And one of the issues that we came across was if it's instituted at a national level, generally what you see is this subtraction method in which you take your net receipts and then you subtract out all of your purchases from intermediate providers. And the other thing that typically happens at a national level is that for a value-added tax, you know, so it's really it's based on what your sales are, the net value of your sales after your purchases. But for most of the developed countries that have a value-added tax, they allow a credit for your exports. So they make it what's called a destination tax. It's based on where the sale takes place. This is something the president has complained about with Mexico, that they have a value-added tax, but as in the European countries as well, if you sell outside of your country, you get a credit. You don't pay the value-added tax. So it does benefit your exporters. Now, at the state level, typically what we've seen, you've got the California proposal here, and similar to what we looked at in Oregon in 2001, is the addition method, in which you're looking at, which from a state level is probably a lot more practical way to apply the tax, and you basically take the components of income that you would have on your corporate income tax return, and we actually mocked up some returns at that time, and you add up those components of value. So you'd have labor income, you'd have rent income for natural resources, you'd have interest for capital. So those are the returns to your factors of production. So you add those up, that becomes the value your company added. And that becomes the basis. So you don't include those things that you purchase from other companies because that's not value you added, it's value that your supplier added. So the problem, and this is discussed at length in this article, with the this addition approach is it is what we call a source-based tax. So it's not a destination-based tax, it's a source-based tax. And the source-based tax, in terms of, if you think about, well, what should be the basis of business taxes? One of the theories is it should reflect the benefits that the company or the business receives. So it's benefits from public services. So if you add up its value, that has a pretty good proxy for the benefits it's receiving from the public sector. The problem is that who pays that? Well, it's your exporters. And if you export, If you export into a destination tax system in another state, then you actually end up being double taxed. And so that's one of the major drawbacks that they talk about here, is that, that the value-added tax at a theoretical level has a lot of positive features. At a practical level, it hasn't been adopted at the state level. Michigan's the only state that had a long-term value-added tax, and that eventually was eliminated. You have a New Hampshire has a relatively minor one in conjunction with a corporate income tax. It's called the business enterprise tax, that has a value-added component, but it's relatively low rate. The final piece here is the corporate income tax, which is what 45 states have, and here you're connecting to the federal base, where you're taking net income. And of course, one of the real drawbacks of net income, there are two of them. One is a very narrow base, C corps only, so you're narrowing the base, and it's net income, so you're narrowing it further, and it have to have a high rate to generate revenue. And that's why you see with the director's chart of general fund, 93% is personal income, only 5% is corporate income taxes for your general fund.
And you're also, we're attached to the federal tax code, so any adjustments made there makes adjustments here too.
That's correct. And, you know, I mean, there's two things there. One is, you know, you can disconnect, but that becomes, in our system, you have to act to do that. So you've got, usually you have to have some lead time where there's uncertainty. And when you do disconnect, then you add administrative complications for taxpayers. And so those are the two things to consider. So just to kind of summarize what the findings are in going through those different approaches, the first thing they did, and we've done this some as well, try to look at, well, if you want to raise an equivalent amount of revenue, what kind of rates do you have off these bases to get the same amount of money? And they calculated their totals for Connecticut, which has a 9% corporate income tax. Of course, we have a 6.6 and 7.6. But the 9% rate would raise the same amount as a 0.64% value-added base. So in other words, the value-added base is, you know, much broader than the corporate income tax base. So it's only 0.2% compared to 9% to raise the same amount of revenue. Now, if you look at the gross receipts base, it's even broader because it's about a third of the value-added rate. And we actually think it's a little bit more from our Oregon data, but about a third of the value-added rate to raise the same amount. So again, the emphasis is the broad base, low rate. The gross receipts tax is the alternative that has those characteristics. This article, if you look through it and kind of what they said, are very negative around the corporate income tax. There's a lot of public finance economists who have become more so. The corporate income tax has shrunk in size over time. I think some of you are aware that OCPP, when they've done an analysis on this a number of times over the years, is showing how the corporate income tax has shrunk relative to the economy and as a revenue generator. And for the Oregon data, but it's true nationally and true at the federal level too, that the corporate income tax has continued to shrink over the last, really its peak as a percentage of GDP was in the early 50s. So it's been going down ever since. So it's become a more and more narrow base. Some of it's just due to the changing structure, changing business organization structure, more sophisticated accounting, globalization. And it's also a lot of it's due to intense pressure among states.
How about federal tax code too?
Federal tax code is a part of that, and that's, you know, I think some of that comes in with globalization, more competition. But as you know, in the discussions you've had around the tax haven legislation, we have real distortions created by our corporate income tax globally.
And it seems like there's more way to defer taxes at the federal level than right.
That's true. That's true. And of course, also what we see is a lot of those, that income ends up being reported and maintained outside the country and outside the tax base.
So what you're seeing is, especially with the larger companies, the sophisticated accounting that you're talking about makes it easier for them to, well, for lack of a better word, disguise profits on which you would base your tax. Mm-hmm. And so a change in policy to a gross receipts tax is saying, you know, okay, we're not going to do cat and mouse anymore with whether you're making money or not. It's a privilege for you to do business in our state. We have publicly financed highways and roads and a publicly educated workforce. So a small, less than 1% rate on your ability to function here is a privilege you pay. And really, the way I would look at it is, instead of saying, you mean you're going to tax us even when we don't make money? And the answer is yes, because you're going to be making money or else you won't last. You won't be here very long. And I think that has worked well in Ohio. And, of course, we know about Washington. So,
In a lot of ways, Mr. Chair, you as the legislature, have made that decision that sales is the best measure through your apportionment formula on the corporate income tax, the single sales factor. Of course, as we talked about, you don't use that same approach with services and intangibles, but with tangible property, the sales factor is an acknowledgement of that, saying, well, sales is the best measure of activity.
We'll fix that problem on Monday, right?
So now, the conclusion of the authors here is that moving to one of these entity-based that are broader-based, as long as you keep a broad base and low rate, of course, you can have credits and exemptions within these bases, too, that has the offsetting effect. But those are important steps to modernization of the fiscal system. The value-added tax, and I think most economists would agree with this, has some real positive theoretical attributes. It avoids the pyramiding that we talked about around a gross receipts tax. It does reflect benefits by the it being economically neutral. That's where I'm referring to. It avoids the pyramiding where you have the taxation at each stage of production and building up to have this differential effect on industries depending on how many transactions they have. But again, as a practical sense, where you've seen most states that have looked at this, if you look at apportionment formulas and what's happened over the last three decades, there has been a very pronounced move to a sales factor. So because of this discussion around exporting and how exporting affects an effort to encourage your exporters and economic development. So this would be inconsistent with that. So if you look at the gross receipts base, you do avoid that double taxation of exporting. That's consistent with a single sales factor. However, because it's a gross receipts tax, and because it's based on transactions, you do run the risk of pyramiding, which is kind of endemic to that approach, and it is the weakness of it. It can't be eliminated as long as you have that base, but states have, in Ohio's case, kept the rate very low at 0.26%. Or in Washington's case, in Nevada's case, had multiple rates where the rates are higher in those sectors that have a minimum amount of transactions, and those sectors that have a lot of transactions have the lower rates to compensate for the fact that you've got these intermediate purchases.
Well, I'd just be curious as to your opinion on this, on pyramiding. It is, you know, economists don't like any tax in public finance. It's kind of pick your poison. Income tax penalizes productivity and wealth. The sales tax is regressive. And they don't like a gross receipts tax because of pyramiding. But is it your opinion that a low overall rate effectively minimizes it and makes it a moot issue almost?
I think a low rate is a good, consistent approach. The advantage of the low rate as opposed to the tiered rate is a tiered rate, you could probably get at it more precisely, but then the trade-off is more complexity. And then you've got, you know, it has to be, and you think about how complicated businesses are, corporations. It has to be their primary activity or primary industry, so you start to get into some real gray areas to where they would fit into different categories. So I think that would be a drawback. So the lower rate's probably the simplest way to go. One thing to keep in mind, and this is as pointed out in this article, that the retail sales tax, and remember in discussions we've had about the council estate taxation and business taxes and what are the taxes that businesses pay across the country. Well, the largest is property tax. The second is the retail sales tax.
Isn't personal property come in there?
No, I'm talking about property taxes in general are the largest. They're about a third of business taxes.
I see
real property and personal property combined.
I see. What you're saying, and I think the author said this too, that there's pyramiding elsewhere.
There's pyramiding within the retail sales tax because you have business-to-business purchases, and instead of talking about you know, half a percent or even a percent rate, you're talking about 5% and 6% rates. So those sectors where you do have a lot of business-to-business purchases that are subject to the retail sales tax, you already have a lot of peer metering. So again, I mean, if you were to throw into the retail sales tax into this comparison, that would obviously be one of the negatives there.
Thank you, Chair Hess. So, Paul, do you know if other states are also looking at doing this? I mean, if it's becoming somewhat obsolete?
Mm-hmm. Well, this study, of course, came from the Connecticut State Level Study Panel.
And I don't know what Connecticut's situation was before this that motivated them to do this.
Well, I think that it's the situation that a lot of states have had. It's trying to address this issue of what's the best way to tax business.
Right.
Concerns about the corporate income tax, that it's becoming obsolete, that it's very narrow, that it's very volatile.
Right.
So I think it's the search for this alternative way to tax business that makes sense. That has, you know, non-distorting on an economic basis,
right,
and adds stability. They mentioned in here, if you look at that chart, and this goes back to Governor Schwarzenegger's time in California. They had a task force, and they recommended a value-added tax.
So, follow-up? Thank you. So, Paul, obviously some sort of modeling's been done of what this would be for Oregon. Mm-hmm. So I asked you a hard question. So if you were perhaps an entity that is not interested in this for whatever reason, what would an entity do to avoid this? What mechanisms would they have available to them? Would it be leaving the state? Would it be changing some sort of filing? I mean, what could be done if someone was not wanting to participate in this?
Well, I think the broad base, of course, is designed, and the reason why it is broad, because there are limited ways to avoid it.
Okay.
But the one you always think about around a gross receipts tax is, if you're taxing these transactions at multiple levels, one way to avoid a tax is vertical integration.
Mm-hmm.
So if you buy your input supplier, and then you don't have a transaction, so you're not paying a tax. So, when we talked about Measure 97 and the sectors that may be most vulnerable, it would be true of any gross receipts-based tax is the wholesale trade sector.
Okay.
Because if you're a wholesale trade and you're selling to distributors within the state, you can move outside the state and then still sell into your final market.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd avoid a transaction that way. But, of course, now we're getting kind of surrounded by gross receipts states with Nevada and Washington. So.
And sales tax.
And sales tax on top of it. That's right.
So really, Senator, I think the answer to your question is they have to leave the state of Oregon.
Well, I as we started working on this a year ago or more, I've had occasion to talk to our larger companies who do business in Ohio, and they're, you know, they don't love it, but as far as a state tax goes, it's like, yeah, we can do Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
They like it a lot better than Oregon's income tax.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's good to know.
It's becoming more and more difficult to administer.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. You do have the, you know, as you go from a corporate structure to a broader entity-based tax, you do have the pass-through entities that will see this because they're paying through the personal income tax, and then this would be an additional cost that would be deductible, but an additional cost to them at the entity level.
So a couple of big policy considerations on this is, do you do it on all entities like Ohio? Do you take, you do it on all entities above $5 million in sales and, you know, leave small business and startups out of it? Do you do the Ohio one rate only or the Nevada 33 rates? And if you do 33 rates, tiered rates, who sets those rates? Is it the legislature? Do you need to, you know, kind of set up a, you know, the equivalent of a base closure commission and, you know, have the team of economists and Paul set up, you know, and study supply chains? Or does that make it too complicated? So there's some huge policy discussions on this because every one of those policies, you know, every one of those changes is affects, you know, the revenues up or down. So,
and of course, the other thing we always recommend is we talked with with you, and they're looking at the various tax reform options. The report we sent out about a year ago, you know, is to use your other taxes too in terms of how you would develop a plan. So whatever, you know, some of the negatives that may be associated with a particular tax, you can compensate for some of that with your other taxes,
yeah,
with other tax changes. So it's a, think of it in terms of a package.
Senator Berkshire.
Yeah, you know, now one thing I've learned being on this committee, there's no perfect plan. But one thing I'm worried about with the gross receipts tax, so is a company that has peaks and valleys, just like the state does in the income, it could be really detrimental, because the years that you're doing really good, it's not a big deal, but the years that you're, because you know, you don't have the contracts, or you're where your contract cycle is, or whatever it is, those years that you're not making money, you're still paying a tax. And because of the banking regulations now, it's getting tougher and tougher to borrow capital to get you through to the good years. And I see a problem for a lot of companies there, you know. So a lot of things to think about.
And Senator, that's obviously one of the trade-offs. If the state has more stability, that means probably from the taxpayer standpoint, they get less flexibility over the business cycle, because they'll have to be making those payments, you know, over the course of the business cycle.
But when we have businesses fail, and now we have people that don't have jobs, because I know a lot of companies, including mine, there's years that, you know, I don't want to lay off people, so I actually take profits from other years just to keep everybody going, you know, until you get back into another cycle that you're making money again. And, you know, that's so there's concern there. There's some concern there.
Well, Paul, you make a good point on this, you know, even in a revenue neutral scenario, makes it adds stability to our Swiss Alps. Already, Oregon's one of the most volatile tax codes in the country, and this stability helps even out some of those peaks and valleys to some extent.
And, you know, another aspect of this that was a major argument for Ohio was just the complexity of the corporate income tax.
Yeah.
And this is obviously much simpler. Either one of these would be, either one of these taxes can be, have a one-page form.
I like that. Nevada is interesting, because they were like a couple of years ahead of Oregon in so much as they had a big ballot measure, gross receipts tax. And it polled very well, and everybody wanted to beat up on the big corporations. They actually hired the same consultant to come in. They had an election, and it was defeated soundly. And then the following year, their legislature and governor passed a more modest gross receipts tax, which is their law now.
But correct me if I'm wrong, I'm sure isn't Nevada has like 33? That's
yep.
The one with 33. Need something a little bit more simpler to stay on the one page. But that back to the one-page form, and I think the real question of the good senator to my left here is that to calculate, and generally speaking, if you say a one-page form, for an entity that's going to do this, there are certain lines on their 1040 or their partnership filing or their sole proprietor that off the federal form that would become the basis of the gross receipts. Is that not correct? How would they calculate it then? I mean, are we exchanging one dinosaur for a new dinosaur? You understand what I'm saying here in terms of, you know, someplace there's a calculation that said this is, you know, their receipts, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, the tax form of the federal is complicated enough that it passive, inactive, all that stuff is sort of separated out. So is there a direct correlation between the federal filing, in which it's much more simplified than them having to keep separate books and do all kinds of other stuff, despite the notion of a one-page form?
Well, I think the two, Senator, the two entity-based taxes, the gross receipts tax, it would basically be the top line on your corporate tax or your Schedule C or whatever business form you're filing. It's that total receipts or total mm-hmm. sales. So that would be the basis for your privilege tax. If you were to go to an origin-based value-added tax, then it would be your labor compensation, your interest, your rent, it'd be those components that are deductions on your corporate income tax. Those would become additions on your value-added tax to determine what your base is.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So let's just assume it's the first line. If you were to go down this line, and it's the very first line that goes on the one-page form. If we did that, I'm trying to figure out the complexity of doing something. What then happens to all of the tax credits, tax deductions, all the other things we already have in our existing law for these entities?
I think the short answer, Senator, it would be they would go away.
Yeah.
Because they would be against your net.
So things like Betsy and all that stuff would just vaporize in front of us.
I mean, you could make some adjustment period. You could make, I mean, you could allow a deduction or credit against any of these bases, against gross receipts. For example, Ohio does have a employment credit that you can use against the CAF when you hire people. But of course, when you do that, the more you do that, the more you narrow the base. That's the trade-off.
Is the theory then from in Ohio then, correct me if I'm wrong here, is that if they do have an exemption for employment, is that they have tried to create a job creation?
That's Texas.
Texas or Ohio?
Mr. Chair, yeah, you're right about Texas has a general where you can deduct your labor compensation. So they're moving close to the net income approach. Ohio, though, has the gross receipts, and they allow credits against the CAT based on it. And I don't know the details of how it's calculated, but based on additional labor, hiring workers, you can use a portion of those wages as a credit against your CAT.
A new job creation, basically.
Right. So the ones you just laid off right after you paid last year's.
Senator, that's always been the difficult one to administer in terms of how you achieve your goals. So, Mr. Chair, we've been working with the chair and with legislative counsel, so we have kind of a package that would look at some of these as committee bills for you to discuss and work around here in the next few weeks at your leisure.
Okay. Well, this is a good discussion.
You know, Mr. Chair, I've seen one of those one-page tax forms. I remember years ago it said gross earnings, and then the second line said send it in.
Yes.
Yes.
All right. Good discussion. In the time we have left, I wanted to pull Kyle up to talk about the senior deferrals and update that program for us. And maybe do that in about 5 or 10 minutes, and then day to do it.
Mr. Chair, I did forget about Christine's has the estate tax that she briefly can go through.
Okay. All right. Go ahead, Kyle.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yeah, I'll try to be pretty brief here. Pick it up again in the basic facts document. Property tax relief begins on page E1 or 54 in the PDF. Yeah, Mr. Chair, as you mentioned, in Oregon, there is primarily only one property tax relief program that's still active. The Elderly Rental Assistance Program did make payments for the last time this past fall. That program per SB 296 of 2015 is being folded into the Department of Housing. So the Senior and Disabled Deferral Program is more or less the last remaining property tax relief program, excluding the 130 or so property tax expenditures that are still available to provide relief in some way, shape, or form. But as a direct relief program, it is the Senior and Disabled Deferral Program. So in the document, there's some background on the deferral program, just kind of hitting the high qualifications. To qualify for the program as a senior, there's an age requirement. It begins at 62 and older. There are income requirements. The most recent is indexed to inflation. I believe the last one was at $43,000 for the 2016-17 tax year, so that does go up with the CPI. There's also limits on the real market value of your home. Of course, that's a function of how many years you've been in your home, so there's a base limit on the real market value, and then the longer the senior has been in the home, the higher that RMD value is, that allows them to qualify for the program. And then there is an overall wealth limit as well that excludes the value of the home. And this program has gone through a series of changes in the last 6 or 7 years. They're detailed in the document, going through the different bills throughout the years. And this really comes from, I'll scroll down to the final chart here. If I can make this a little bit larger. But you can see the program, what you're looking at here are the taxes paid by the state and the repayments of the state. And I should probably back up. The setup of the deferral program is seniors or disabled individuals that apply and qualify for the program, they have their property taxes paid by the state. So the taxes are paid, the local governments do receive those collections, and then it becomes a liability to the state to make those, to pay back the state for the deferred property taxes. And those repayments come in at the time you sell your home, or it could be in the case of if the senior, both seniors, in the case of a married couple, if they pass away and the home is sold at that time, that's when they repay the deferred balance owed to the state. But it was back in, it was about the 07-08 time period where the program for a number of years, for 15 years or so prior, back in the early 90s, had been receiving repayments from participants at a level greater than the payments that were going out. And that you can see it's in the red bars show the repayments, and the blue line or the blue bars are the payments going out. So the program was every year was having more and more money coming into the program than was having to go back out. One of the changes was then to use some of that funding to support Oregon Project Independence. So then it would transfer the money from the excess balance in the deferral program would go to fund OPI. When that change was made, it was right about that time we had the housing bubble started to burst, and the program found itself for the first time in 15 years or so where payments going out of the program were now higher than repayments coming in. So there was a cash flow issue. And that's what really started off some of these series of changes that have tightened the program requirements and been some changes to aim it at those lower value homes and tightening up some of the wealth restrictions and such. So what we've seen over the past few years is, again, we have repayments are once again looking stronger. Part of that is the housing sales have picked back up. So we're seeing repayments coming back in. And there really has been this shift down in the payments going back out, so the deferral payments made by the state, due to some of the tightening from those that can apply for the program. But so as of right now, the program is, I think last time I looked, had 20 plus million in the balance right now available. And that was after making the payments in November. So it's on a much more solid solid footing. And that, I think that's my pretty quick, brief overview. There's definitely a lot to chew on. We can get into more details as you want, but just as a quick hit of the overview of the program. I will leave it there, and if there's any questions.
Questions? Thank you, Kyle.
Okay.
Steve?
I want to make it moot.
Are you picking on the seniors again?
No. I'm going to make this program moot. We don't have to do it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Christine Broniak with the Legislative Revenue Office. I'm here today to talk about the estate taxes. So there had been a number of changes in the estate tax statutes recently. However, the currently it's on estate values that are valued greater than or equal to $1 million. And if there is a value of the estate of $1 million in Oregon, the estate is then to a tax in Oregon. There's a schedule here. You can see the rates vary from 10% all the way up to 16%. And that depends on the value of the estate. And so then there's a ratio of the state estate at a national level, and it would be applied to the estate, and it would give the estate the amount of estate in Oregon. And the resident ratio is given here, includes various types of property as a ratio to the total value. And the non-resident ratio is a little different in that it doesn't include intangible personal property. There are a number of deductions available when calculating the taxable estate, including funeral expenses, debts, mortgages, and liens, bequests, and gifted charities. It's possible to bequest the estate to a surviving spouse, and that acts effectively as a deferral of tax. The property for which a marital deduction is allowed must be included in the value of the gross estate when the spouse that received the benefit of the deduction dies, and so it can be deferred that way. There is also a natural resource credit, and this was developed to sort of deal with the values of farms or forestries or commercial fishing businesses. And the credit's unavailable to estates with a value of greater than $15 million nationally, or where the value of a natural resource property in Oregon is less than 50% of the value of the estate in Oregon. And so the natural resource credit is calculated there. And so there's a bit of a history in this document of the inheritance and estate tax and all the iterations that got it to the point where it is today. You can see the amount of tax here and the detailed tables. It's now amounting to about 1,500 returns and 140 million in payable tax. And so it's a bit of a revenue source for Oregon. Here you can see the breakdown of the various types of Oregon estate values and the amount of tax that came from each of them. The 10 million plus category is the highest category. Some of these larger value estates can really make the revenue source change quite a bit from year to year as they constitute such a high value relative to the lower value estates.
So 2015, 140 million, that was just 2015.
Yes.
So if you looked at a biennium, you wouldn't necessarily double that, but effectively that'd be 2 years worth.
Mr. Chair, yes, most likely. I mean, it could be that 2015 is an outlier. However, it seems that this has been kind of building throughout the years. This seems to be almost a steady trend upward. I mean, a little bit of a uneven growth rate, but it will be interesting to see if it continues.
Aging population.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, it could be that Oregon's attracting wealthier retirees. If there's some nice places with natural resources, that they want to be here. That's speculation on my part. But here's a more detailed table, having to do with the payable tax by estate size, and you can see the breakdowns. In all the previous years, and there's some statistics here on the averages, the tax by estate size, and the larger estates pay the most, a greatest share of that. And then there's just some more information about the receipts. The in 2015-16, the receipts grew from 13% from the 2014 fiscal year, so it's a little bit of a different window than before, but also it shows that trend of them growing. And with that, I can take any questions.
Questions on the estate tax?
Don't die in Oregon.
Don't die in Oregon. Okay. Thank you, Christine.
You're welcome.
Well, we could probably spend 2 hours or 2 days on school, on the Byzantine way we finance schools in the state. I don't know that we're going to do justice to it in 10 minutes. Perhaps we could squeeze this into something next week.
If you'd like, Mr. Chair, and carry it over till Monday and try to get to it then, and then if not, we carry it over to Tuesday.
Yeah, let's if you guys are okay, let's carry it over.
Yeah. We've been through that rodeo before.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Everybody but Kathleen.
Okay, so we'll take that up.
So when we do that,
it's kind of a hazing thing.
Kathleen and you need to be here.
Yeah. All right. Thank you all for the discussion. Very interesting. And we will see you Monday. We are adjourned.
next week.
Monday. We are adjourned.